Ia ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano u a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16-0000630, State of Hawaii v. Williams. Arguing for the petitioner, Eric A. Seitz. Arguing for the respondent, Sonia P. McCullen, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning and aloha. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. We were not able to obtain closed captioning during our live broadcast, but we will be getting this argument captioned and then post it after the conclusion of the proceedings today on the on our YouTube channel. I'd like to thank Judge Gary Chang for sitting in with the court today by reason of vacancy. Thank you, Judge Chang. During the proceedings, if a justice has a question, they'll raise their hand and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. And I'd like to ask at this time our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they will be arguing.
Good morning. Eric Seitz representing the appellant.
Very well, thank you. Oh, Ms. McCullen, you're about there. Sorry, your mic was off.
Sorry. Good morning, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii.
All right. Thank you to you both. Just to confirm, Mr. Seitz, you've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. So you'll at 10 minutes in, we'll have a light and a tone for you just to indicate you that we've reached that point. Ms. McCullen, you'll have 30 minutes for your argument, and you'll see a light and tone, both of you, at the end of your allotted time. And also, Ms. McCullen will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. So with that, if you would, please proceed, Mr. Seitz, with your argument.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to appear in front of you this morning. And thank you to the court staff for all the effort that have been invested to facilitate this process. This is a case in which there is only one witness who could testify about the alleged events in the indictment. And that was a young man whom I will refer to as T.Y. The only issue in this case was the credibility of that one witness, T.Y. And yet the prosecutor was allowed to call 8 witnesses simply and for the only purpose of bolstering T.Y.'s credibility. They had no relevant information or testimony. Purely and simply, those 8 witnesses were there to try to impress the jury that T.Y. was truthfully reporting what happened to him. The only possible corroboration in this case could and would have been the phone calls that Mr. Williams allegedly made to T.Y. to implore him to remain quiet. In the videotaped statement that T.Y. gave to Detective Sato, he said the calls came after the second incident, which would have placed them, by that testimony, in May or June of 2012. The police and the prosecutor did nothing to verify those calls. We subpoenaed and went through hundreds of pages of records looking for the calls and couldn't find any. I have in front of me about 6 inches worth of documents from the phone companies by which we looked at every possible way those calls could have been documented and recorded. At trial, T.Y. changed his story and testified, well, maybe the calls occurred between the two incidents. And again, we went looking for records and found none. So confronted with a case in which she had no corroboration whatsoever, the prosecutor was allowed to call witnesses who improperly bolstered the credibility of T.Y. and to engage in a repeated and pervasive misconduct prior to and throughout the trial. I want to read to you from the transcript the opening statement that the prosecutor made when she provided her argument, her closing argument. And this is what she said at page 67 of the transcript for May 6, 2016, docket number 43. She said in very dramatic tones, unpleasant, nasty, beyond imagination, but now the secret is out. This man, this defendant, is upset, is mad. He's mad because he begged and he begged that 14-year-old not to tell. But Detective Sato, he found the truth. He interviewed her. He interviewed witnesses. He visited the scene. He conducted an investigation and he found the truth And now this case is before you. Now that statement, that quotation, in and of itself was so inflammatory and so wrong and so unprofessional that I believe that it warrants a reversal of the conviction in and of itself. But there's a lot more. There were questions asked of three witnesses by the prosecutor in which he asked those witnesses, who basically were credibility, character witnesses for my client, whether or not they approved of sucking a child's penis is something you would expect to see in public. She asked that three times. Why that question was even asked in the context of this case of those witnesses was simply to inflame the jury. From the outset, up to and during trial, the prosecutor held on.
Mr. Seitz, we have a question from Justice Wilson.
Yes.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Mr. Seitz, you were just referring to this line of questioning that the prosecutor had for the character witnesses that had to do with the details of the allegations in this case. And the ICA, as I'm sure you know, found that this was proper, that it was relevant, because it was a way to show that the character witnesses did not really understand the background of the defendant, I think that's essentially what the ICA's view was, that it was relevant to sort of impeach this opinion that the witness had of the character of the complaining witness, the defendant. So could you respond to that?
Sure. First of all, I think if you go back and you read those interactions, you will see that those witnesses, in part, were testifying about events involving TY, in which we thought that there was relevant information about why he was becoming alienated from this family and why he would make the claims that he did. They did not provide any information that would be relevant to the kind of inquiry that the prosecutor blurted out. The first time she blurted it out, we were shocked. It was the last question she asked, and then she sat down.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but are you suggesting that they weren't really character witnesses?
They were character witnesses, but they were not character witnesses in any sense that kind of comment, as far as I can tell, was in any way relevant either to the testimony they gave or to any opinions that they might have expressed. That just came out of left field, and it was shocking. And it was shocking the first time it happened. The second time, we objected, and the objection was sustained. And yet the prosecutor then did it a third time.
Mr. Seitz, it was sustained or overruled? I'm sorry.
So the second time when we made the objection, it was sustained.
Very well.
But then the prosecutor did it a third time. And again, at that point, he was out. It didn't make a lot of sense to object. My young colleague basically had sat down, and that was the end of the questioning of these witnesses. But the question was asked of all three of these witnesses as kind of a last way of expressing the prosecutor's disdain, apparently, for the fact that these witnesses would come forward at all. It has no relevance whatsoever to the context of their testimony or to the kind of testimony that they gave. So I frankly disagree with the characterization that this in any way was related to any characteristics or any testimony that they were offering. Going back, again, as I said, we had constant problems.
Judge Chang has a question, Mr. Seitz. Well, Judge Chang, you have to unmute. Oh, okay, we got you.
Can you hear me now, Mr. Seitz?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to clarify, follow up on CJ's question. Did you say that there were three such statements and you objected twice and they were sustained?
No. I said there were three statements. The first statement we were shocked by, we didn't react. The second one, my colleague who was trying the case with me objected, and the objection was sustained. And then in the next witness, the third witness, prosecutor did the same thing. We did not object on that occasion.
the objection that you articulated was as to Autumn Butler, the witness?
I don't recall, Judge, but I think so.
Now, my recollection is that objection was overruled.
You may be correct. I thought it was sustained. I remember we made one objection. In any event, if I'm wrong about that, I apologize, but I still believe that none of those statements had any basis professionally or in terms of relevance in this case being made. Certainly not to those people. It was basically made for shock value. Moving on, in her closing argument, the prosecutor then accused us of delaying the trial so our witnesses could conspire to fabricate, and then referred to our comments about the fact that there was no evidence in this case indicating that our client had any desire sexually for young men or men at all as an ugly prejudice. And then basically she went on from there and argued that the case had been proven and substantially corroborated by the witnesses that she had called. During my closing argument, as you know, she made 9 separate objections. The ICA brushed that aside and said, well, 4 of them were sustained. Well, if you go back and look at those objections, and I could go through them one by one if you like, but I would encourage you to do that, at least 3 of them that were sustained wrongly. They were comments on the evidence, and the evidence is there. But the fact that a prosecutor would object 9 times during a closing argument, in this instance, suggests to me that that was misconduct. It wasn't made for any legitimate purpose other than to disrupt and other to have an impact on the jury, which I believe it clearly did. In every instance, I was commenting upon the evidence, which I was entitled to do. I was interpreting the evidence, which I was entitled to do. And in our view, those objections were misconduct during the course of our argument. I want to turn briefly to Dr. Bivens. Dr. Bivens testified, and Dr. Bivens is well known to this court. He initially was named as a witness, and we requested his opinions. We never got any opinions. What we got was 500 pages of articles from various journals. And when we inquired, we were told, well, he's going to testify to matters that are in these articles. The next thing was we filed a motion in limine, which Judge Ahn essentially deferred to trial after the prosecutor said that Dr. Bivens would be testifying on the dynamics of sexual abuse, whatever that meant. On the day that Dr. Bivens was scheduled to testify, this court handed down the decision in State v. Coney, which we all then read on the record and talked about. On the basis of Coney, it became clear to me, at least, that this court would allow Dr. Bivens to testify as an expert by virtue of the fact that he's a psychologist and his practice concerns adolescence and sex abuse claims. So I withdrew my motion with regard to him testifying at all. But the prosecutor now claimed that Dr. Bivens would testify as to delayed reporting, not the dynamics of sex abuse. However, that was never an issue in this case. We never raised it. It wasn't part of our defense. That was never an issue for us in this case, and it never came up from our standpoint. Our defense was that it never happened. Our defense was that the testimony and the statement given to the detective by T.Y. was not credible and certainly wasn't sufficient. But over repeated and constant questions, the judge allowed Dr. Bivens to testify and essentially, as I said, bolster the testimony of T.Y. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, if you compare this case to Coney, what the court said in essence in that case was that there has to be a weighing process, weighing the prejudice of the testimony versus the relevance. And that's, of course, what the rule requires. In Coney, the court said that there was insufficient prejudice, among other reasons, because there were 2 other witnesses who testified that the defendant had made admissions in which he had apologized for the conduct with which he was charged. This is not that case. There was no other evidence. And Dr. Bivens' appearance and testimony in this case was in no way related to any actual issues in this case. And in our view, the trial judge at some point had an obligation, if not at trial, certainly on our motion for judgment of acquittal, to look back and to say that the admission of Dr. Bivens' testimony was erroneous and that it was clearly prejudicial.
Mr. Seitz, could I ask you to address the issue related to a conversation between the complaining witness's father and the defendant driving up to the North Shore. I believe your claim there or your assertion is that there was a lack of disclosure of the contents of the statement. Could you explain that and explain how that prejudiced the defense in your view?
Well, first of all, yes, we were never given any warning that that was coming. It was never disclosed to us at any time. It was disclosed that the father was going to testify. He had been interviewed. We had a brief notation in the police report, but we had no idea that he was going to mention anything that was said to him of any relevance by my client. When he testified, he said that basically the essence of his testimony was that Mr. Williams invited him to go with him to look at the roof on his house up in Laie. But when he got there, it didn't appear to be that there was any real problem with the roof. Although Mr. Williams testified, and I think the father admitted on cross-examination, that there was some issue about rust that my client was concerned about. But it was the contention of the prosecutor and the contention of the father that Mr. Williams basically just wanted to have this discussion because he was concerned about the son and anything the son might have said regarding those incidents that had occurred. But frankly, there was no testimony about the essence of what was said, but the event itself was used to suggest that somehow Mr. Williams expressed some sort of guilt or some sort of remorse by virtue of the fact that he had this conversation or invited the father to go with him at all. And as I say, I think there was no relevance of that. It never materialized. It was never disclosed. And had we known about it, we certainly would have filed a motion in limine before it even ever came up. But we did not.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Seitz. Was that testimony found to be improper by the trial court, and consequently, did the trial court give an instruction to the jury?
No, all the trial court did was prevent the father from saying anything specific that my client had said, but the gist of the whole event was allowed to be presented to the jury.
So there's a specific I'm sorry to interrupt you, but part of the reason I bring that up is it appears that the ICA found that it was important that the trial court had limited the testimony, but it's your view that that testimony actually was significant that was presented to the jury?
Yes. So let me just say, lastly, I would like to...
Could I ask one other thing, Mr. Seitz? And
of course.
Perhaps this is where you were going, but I wanted to ask you about this interaction with between the complaining witness and his friend, I believe the initials SS, involving some form of written message. And again, I think your conclusion or your contention is that the fact that there may have been something in writing was not disclosed to the defense, or the substance of that writing was not disclosed. Can you explain to us where the trial court, in your view, erred with regard to that issue?
Well, first of all, we filed a motion in limine with regard to the testimony of not only that young lady, but another child friend, who were scheduled to testify. The judge granted the motion in limine and said they cannot testify as to statements that were made to them by TY. But the prosecutor called them anyway and provided testimony about the circumstances and the nature of what was said in those conversations without telling us specifically what was said. And in essence, what was presented to the jury was that on those occasions that TY had been allowed to present the gist of what he was claiming to those people and thereby corroborated to them that he was reporting what had happened without any specific words. But it was allowed to be conveyed to the jury nonetheless that these witnesses supported the credibility of TY because he had told them what happened without actually providing the words of what he told them.
All right, Judge Chang.
Mr. Seitz, did the trial court permit the witness to explain about this app that was used and how it was that it works and what the witness observed about the demeanor of complaining witness TY after that electronic computer message was reviewed by SS?
Yes. I see my time is up. I would at this point reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Very well. Thank you, Mr. Seitz. If there are no other questions from the court at this time, I'll ask Ms. McCullen to present her argument. Ms. McCullen.
Good morning. I guess I'll start with the questions that Chief Justice Rechtenwald raised regarding the drive to defendant's beach house with father. Admittedly, there is a problem there because although the circuit court did sanction the state by excluding any of defendant's statements from coming in, some actually did prior to defense's objection. And so there is a problem there. And those statements specifically were, no, I'm going to ride with you. And no, I need a ride with you. And all he could talk about was TY. But after reviewing these statements, it appears harmless. The statements didn't satisfy any element. And as defense counsel noted, appears irrelevant. And defense counsel was able to cure any prejudice on cross-examination when he got out that, yes, there was some rust. And that they talked about other topics like photography and fishing.
Oh, Ms. McCullen, we have a question from Justice Nakia.
Ms. McCullen, regarding the whether or not it was error or it was harmful or harmless to have the statements in, is it problematic that when the statements of the defendant started being elicited, that defense counsel objected that he didn't have any notice? And the prosecutor said, well, I just found out myself. I can't remember whether she said this morning or yesterday or something like that. Doesn't the prosecutor have a duty to disclose to the defense if the prosecutor becomes aware of a statement the defendant made? Doesn't
she have a duty? Absolutely, she does.
So even though that has a problem, it might be harmless insofar as what the substance came in. I'm not saying that it is, but in case it is, doesn't that kind of add to the specter of prosecutorial abuse, if not misconduct, by skirting the edges of the requirements of the rules?
Yes, there was a discovery violation, definitely. The substance of this conversation should have been reported to or turned over to the defense counsel, and I can't find anything in the record where it was. And so the state acknowledges that right off the bat. And the court addressed the objection and the discovery violation and by extension, the misconduct by sanctioning the state. And I guess although defense counsel raises prosecutorial misconduct and admission of evidence as issues on appeal, actually, I think the issue on appeal would be whether the court abused its discretion in the sanction because it addressed those issues below. And so on appeal, it probably should be more like did the court abuse its discretion by not sanctioning the state enough?
But did you just say that even though the court sanctioned her and told her not to go into it, statements still, did she still elicit statements or they just came?
No, sorry. Those statements I recited were prior to the objection.
All right.
And so, but it wasn't stricken from the record. So that's problematic. Sorry, Justice Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. McCullen. I wanted to ask your help in explaining the position that it's really was harmless from the point of view that it appeared that there was just one government witness. In this case, it was the complaining witness that described what happened. So that meant there was a credibility issue. And if you have a relatively independent witness, a father of the daughter who's the friend of the complaining witness, he gives his opinion that it was odd that there was so much discussion about the complaining witness. And in addition to that, it was odd. He'd never even had a client who had ever wanted to engage in that kind of interest in the proposed job, that he would get in the car and drive out and discuss this proposed employment with him. So wouldn't that constitute a type of bolstering, if you will, or it would support the credibility of the complaining witness because you have what seems to be a pretty independent witness noting that this is quite unusual in his experience and all the defendant wanted to do was talk about the complaining witness. Do you think that's helpful to the government or it's not helpful enough to be error that's not harmless?
Actually, what I think is that it undercuts TY's credibility because what it showed was that a defendant had no problem asking a neighbor for help. And it seemed like their relationship was same and it was same as always. Nothing changed. And defense counsel actually had a similar argument with the two couples, defendant and wife, and TY's parents having dinner. Defense counsel argued that it showed that the relationship didn't change and defendant wasn't uncomfortable being around them. The same thing here. The defendant wasn't uncomfortable asking for his neighbor's help. And that undercuts actually TY's credibility.
Ms. McCullen, could you address the issue of the three very graphic questions that were asked by the prosecutor of the witnesses that Mr. Seitz alluded to?
Yes. So the first one was with Ms. Kai Barrett. And the testimony there was defense counsel asked in direct something to the effect of, she's been around children and there has been no inappropriate conduct or no reports of inappropriate conduct. And across, the state asked the question that defense counsel
what is the legitimate purpose in asking the question in that manner? I mean, we cannot... why ask the question in that in that manner?
I think it was to show that this is something that's not done in public. So although she's seen defense counsel with children and has had no reports that there's been anything inappropriate, this is not something that's done in public or that you would do in front of someone like Ms. Kai Barrett, who's the manager of the opera. But the words, sucking a child's penis, I mean, it wasn't, pretty much those words were in the charge and the charge was read to the jury. Okay. TY already testified as to these acts. So I don't think it's as shocking or inflammatory as defense is making it out to be.
All right. Justice Nakayama had a question.
Sorry.
Kind of a question and a comment. Like, really? It's not shocking? You know, you can get the same gist across by just saying, well, you know what? I don't need to tell a prosecutor how to try a case, but clearly not clearly. How is that comment not meant to inflame the jury? First off, calling a 15-year-old adolescent a child. So, I mean, that, and then the phrases that are used instead of a generalized comment, how is that not intended to inflame a jury?
Well,
pretty graphic.
Again, I understand your point of view, and that is the defense counsel's argument that it was meant to inflame the jury, but those acts were already presented to the jury, and it was meant to show that although these witnesses are testifying that they didn't see inappropriate behavior like what defendant is alleged to have done to TY is not something you would do in front of Ms. Ka'ai Barrett or Ms. Morgan. And to clarify Judge Chang's question, as to Ka'ai Barrett, there was an objection. There was no objection. And as to AB, there was an objection, and it was sustained as, I forget why it was sustained, but it was sustained. And as to Morgan, there was no objection.
Well, wait a minute. Isn't that a problem then? If it was sustained and then she went ahead and said it again?
It was sustained because AB, where it was sustained, wasn't asked that inappropriate or around children and whether there was any reports of inappropriate behavior. That wasn't asked of AB, but it was asked of Ka'ai Barrett and Morgan.
We have a question first from Justice Wilson and then Justice McKenna. Justice Wilson and then Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Ms. McCullen, I am also interested in the way that character witnesses will be impeached in the future, because this technique certainly offers the opportunity for all graphic crimes to be repeated to character witnesses. For example, if there was a murder that was a very gruesome murder, and it was a murder that meant that a character witness was called by the defense, I guess, is it the government's view now that that character witness can then be told each of the facts that constituted the murder in order to make the point that the nature of the murder was something that this character witness wouldn't know about? Is that your idea, that it's the free, I guess I would say it's a free reign approach where the character witness can be consulted about all the facts because they're in the indictment?
No, but what happened in this case was that it was in response to what was asked in direct. And so if it's within the scope of direct examination.
I grant you that. Let's assume that there was some element of relevance because the character witness gets up and says, I've never observed anything inappropriate. And then as an effort to impeach the witness, the prosecutor says, well, and then goes into all this inappropriate behavior where the defendant engaged in a gruesome murder. I mean, I'm just wondering I guess you're saying that the prosecutor can go as far as they want in just reciting the facts.
No, I don't believe so. But like in this case, the trial court helped control it, and defense counsel objected. And so it depends on, I guess, the flow of the questioning. It's not free reign for whatever comes up. I mean, for whatever the prosecutor wants.
Thank you. Just to be clear, though, you don't feel this was inappropriate behavior by the prosecutor?
I don't believe it was misconduct, because in it was in direct response to the direct examination questions.
Justice McKenna, your question.
Thank you. Ms. McCullen, I'd like to direct your attention toward the statement, the computer statement to SS. And I just want to make sure I understand the procedural history and what happened. Is my understanding correct that there was actually a motion in limine granted as to any statements made by TY to SS? But despite the grant of that, the prosecutor said in opening statement that and that he sent her a message on the computer, and then she testified that she went ahead and testified that, you know, she had read it. And his reaction, and she also testified that I know if he wasn't lying, he would tell me the truth. I'm just wondering, I thought there was a motion limine granted. Why would these things come up if a motion limine had been granted?
Okay. Yes, there was. It was sort of granted, and I'm trying to look for it now. It was granted, but subject to any exceptions, and... I believe the court, it wasn't a complete no.
Right. So it happened to have been a hearsay exception. So what hearsay exception would apply to a complaining witness stating what happened?
So I'm sorry. I have to take a little bit of a step back because, and the state filed a motion for, judicial notice recently, and it was denied by Justice Wilson, but in it, the state provided some information regarding SS and the discovery, and it's in the court records, and I think according to HCRR Rule 4,
The motion was denied, so you asked us to take... That information, the motion was denied. So it's physically in the record of the court, but it's not something that we have.
Okay. So I won't cite to it, but I'll cite to what I can. And in the motion in limine, defense counsel does say that he, although regarding the opening statement, he claimed, "We're hearing about this message for the very first time, or for the first time. It's never been disclosed to us." In the second motion in limine, he says, "Based on the discovery provided in this case, I am informed and believe that the prosecution intends to present evidence of oral statements made by the alleged victim."
Right. So I'm not asking you about a discovery violation. I'm asking you about a motion in limine order violation. It appears that the court did exclude this evidence, yet the prosecutor starts talking about it in opening statement. And I understand that the motion in limine was qualified, saying there has to be a hearsay exception. So yes. Therefore, my question is, first of all, why would it be mentioned in opening statement when the motion in limine had already been granted? But second of all, what hearsay exception could apply to the statement of a complaining witness under these circumstances? It's not an excited utterance.
Right.
So no, exception could apply under these in this situation?
I don't think there was a hearsay exception. I think what the court said during the hearing on the motion in limine was that unless the government can come up with a hearsay exception, we litigate the matter outside the presence of the jury. And then during the opening statement, that's where the prosecutor or the state goes into learning about, or that the friends learned about what happened. And then that was all stricken.
So the prosecutor's statement and opening statement was stricken?
Yes.
But the testimony was actually received in any event.
What happened after that was the SS started to testify, or it was testifying, and then the prosecutor explained to defense and the judge that there's the actual computer statement doesn't exist because of this, it kind of disappears. And so the substance, or I guess the observations of SS or SS's observations of TY were allowed in.
After reading the statement, the nature of the statement, and she says he doesn't lie. It's pretty clear what she had read.
Yes, and that, I mean, I have to say that was provided to defense counsel.
And the motion in limine had been granted, yet it came into evidence. All right, thank you.
So
question from Justice Wilson and then one from Justice Nakayama. I apologize, I was on mute. Justice Wilson.
Well, I can defer to Justice Nakayama. I've asked lots of questions here.
So. Works for everything. Yeah. Thank you, Justice Wilson. Ms. McCullen, I want to go back to the objection made by defense counsel with those statements describing the offenses. What was the objection made by defense counsel that was sustained?
I'm sorry, what topic are we talking about?
I'm sorry, you know, the three statements, the three questions that were of a questionable nature describing. And the second, you mentioned that the second one was the second witness, an objection was made and it was sustained. But what was the objection?
The objection was the objection was, I believe, argumentative.
That's all right. I can find out. I'm just curious as to, I mean, if the objection was only that it wasn't relevant to the, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Objection was argumentative, and the court said it's beyond the scope.
All right. Thank you.
Direct examination.
All right, Judge Chang has a question.
Thank you. Ms. McCullen, I'd like to go back to the computer statement to SS. When did the prosecution first learn of the existence of that statement?
That's in the motion I filed, which I don't think I can talk about.
Is there anything in the record that you can't that discusses this issue other than what was not of which we didn't take judicial notice?
No.
Okay, so
all right, thank you.
Very well. Ms. McCullen, continue.
Okay, so let's see. There were other, defense counsel discussed the accusation of delaying the trial, but I think that's a misrepresentation of, as the ICA did note, of what was actually said. And as to the homosexual bias, as the ICA said, it's a misstatement of what was actually said. And as to Dr. Bivens, defense counsel keeps repeating that he never received, or the state never turned over any report. And The state explained from the get-go back on December 8th, 2014, that it doesn't exist. There is no report. Dr. Bivens is not has not examined this boy or even met him. And curiously, defense counsel did not order that transcript for the appellate review. And also in that transcript, the state explained that he will be testifying as to delayed reporting. And so I think those claims defense makes regarding Dr. Bivens and discovery is false. Yes?
All right, Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Ms. McCollin, I wanted to get your thoughts about the parameters of the government's obligation to produce discovery pursuant to Rule 16. Following up on what you just mentioned, if we look at the section of Rule 16 that refers to the requirements to disclose reports of experts, it says reports or statements of experts. Now, would it be fair to say that your position is that the statements that are referred to are written statements? In other words, obviously there was a statement made by Dr. Bivens to the government, right? Because the government would have to prepare the witness. So I wanted to ask you, is that your position with respect to section the subsection? It says reports or statements, because what's interesting about it is if you look at the subsection just above it, there's a requirement to produce any written or recorded statements that have to do with and the substance of any oral statements made by the defendant. But it's not quite that specific when it comes to experts. It just says any reports or statements. So I wanted your help and understanding what you think that means, a statement of an expert.
I think we have to keep reading to where it says which were made in connection with the particular case. And there was no report or statement made.
I will grant to you it needs to have to do with the case. But if the prosecution's meeting with an expert witness about a case and the expert witness is explaining his or her view of the case, wouldn't that be statements that are being made in relation to the case?
Well, they're not. He's not explaining his view of the case. He's explaining his understanding of delayed reporting, which is what the state explained and provided that he's relying on.
But isn't the delayed reporting testimony being offered in a particular case with the understanding that it is relevant? I mean, that's almost a literal requirement, right? You can't have an expert testify and not have them testify about the case. It's got to be relevant, right?
Well, yes, the state had to lay foundation as to his expertise
sure.
with teenage boys and whatnot.
And that foundation has its genesis in large part in the conversations that the prosecution has with the expert witness before the expert witness testifies. So the prosecution can know what they're going to say and establish the foundation. So, but don't let me put words in your mouth. Is it your view that actually Bivens wasn't testifying about this case? Is that your point? And that's why it wouldn't be necessary to produce statements that pertain to his testimony?
He wasn't testifying about T.Y. in particular, no. He was testifying about...
I didn't ask you about T.Y. I was interested in the language of the rule that says, in connection with a particular case. And one might logically think that when an expert provides testimony, they're testifying about or in connection with a particular case. But is it your view that that's not really true, that Bivens wasn't testifying with respect to a particular case?
He's testifying as to delayed reporting, which is what happened in this case. And so in that respect, that's how it's relevant. But other than I think he testified that other than the general age of TY, he didn't know anything about the case.
Okay, and then I'm sorry to belabor this, but there's another section of this rule that I'd be interested in your thoughts about that has to do with the statements of the defendant, because it says any written or recorded statements and the substance of any oral statements. I wanted to ask you about what disclosure is required under that section, Rule 16. In other words, a disclosure could mean that there's a statement that the defendant makes to somebody, and it's in the documentation that the government has. And so that documentation that includes perhaps many, many statements, could be extensive documentation, is produced without identifying any statements specifically of the defendant. So my question is, does this disclosure require a actual specific notification of the defense as to what statements will be used and what statements have been made by the defendant?
I don't think it limits it to what will be used, but if the defendant made a statement, yes, the state has to turn it over.
Well, I didn't mean turn it over. This says disclose, but maybe you've answered my question. As long as it's turned over, even if it's turned over in the midst of hundreds of pages of discovery, then that satisfies the requirement, right? It's not necessary to actually identify for the defense the statements.
Like have it packaged nicely? I mean, I'm not sure, but...
Packaging might be one way to do it. You could package a section that's got the defendant's statements, but I suppose it'd be possible to just identify in response, maybe in referring to what the statements are of the defendant.
I think what happens most times is if there is a defense statement, it's in the police report, and the police reports have it all nicely delineated who it is and what they're saying. And then it's usually recorded, and it's on a CD or DVD, as it was in this case. And then that's turned over.
Right? What's the defendant's statement on a DVD?
If it's video, yes. And it's usually identified.
Whether there was a statement of the defendant that was on a DVD in this case.
Wait, I'm sorry?
You referred to statement of a defendant on a DVD as in this case. Was there a statement by the defendant on a DVD that was produced for the defense in this case?
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess that's part of the motion of judicial notice too, and I can't talk about that.
Oh, well, you can talk about the nature of the record in the sense of whether you have any knowledge of the defendant's statement, a statement recorded of the defendant. I just haven't seen one in the record in any event. So am I correct? As far as you know, there's no actual recorded statement of the defendant?
Chief Justice,
is there anything in the record outside of the motion to take judicial notice that you're aware of that addresses a question of whether there was a CD of a statement by the defendant?
No, it's in the motion.
Okay. Justice Wilson, does that resolve your question?
Okay. Thank you.
Again, I appreciate you've come up to the your 30 minutes, Ms. McCollum, but I certainly want to give you the chance to wrap up in any way with final thoughts for the court or any other points. Oh, I'm sorry. Judge Chang had a question. I apologize. We'll get Judge Chang's question, and then you can wrap up at that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wanted to follow up with Justice Wilson's question. Ms. McCollum, if the state intends to introduce an opinion of an expert, that's the intention. Is the state required to disclose the intention to introduce that opinion to the defense?
The state is required. Yes, I would say so. The state should.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Ms. McCollum, you can wrap up with any final thoughts for the court at this point.
So the state would ask this court to affirm defendant's sexual assault convictions because and I guess we didn't really discuss the character witness or the exclusion of THS and KT, but there really wasn't a violation of his right to present a complete defense because you really have to read the transcripts and take everything into context and know the order of what happened and what the court actually excluded, because the court excluded testimony and not witnesses. And the testimony it did exclude was as to based on the rules of evidence, specifically relevance and cumulativeness. The state thanks the court. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ms. McCollum. Mr. Seitz, your rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to respond.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I missed. I apologize. Justice Nakayama had one last question. Please.
No. I wanted to ask Mr. Seitz.
I'm sorry. Let's jump in with your question for Mr. Seitz.
Okay, Mr. Seitz, I understand that you did file a motion for a new trial, or to set aside the verdict, or I think a JA, based on prosecutorial misconduct. But I'm concerned after the Ms. McCollum said about whether or not you preserved your objection to the questionable way that the prosecutor phrased her the act that the defendant was accused of to the three witnesses. I don't think, did your objection encompass that this was an improper question because of the phrasing and it was prosecutorial misconduct? And was it, so therefore was it preserved for a consideration?
Off the top of my head, I can't really answer that, but I believe that we raised all of the cumulative errors of the prosecutor's abrasiveness, of her outrageous comments that she made repeatedly, all of which I think we've raised in the brief in the ICA. So I think we did repeat those, we made objections. I believe they are adequately preserved, but even if they're not, I would urge the court to consider that these were obvious errors that the trial court had an obligation to take some curative actions and failed to do so. With respect to the comment to the three witnesses, it was sustained as to the second, and she made it a third time. And that kind of brazen misconduct, in my view, is something that the trial court had an obligation to address and did not. If I may just make a couple of comments. First of all, with regard to the witnesses, the additional witnesses we wanted to call that were excluded, two of those witnesses were young men who had spent substantial time as friends of the son, Josh, in the house. And they had very important observations to provide about the fact that they were fully secure there, that there was never any behavior of any sort by Mr. Williams toward them that was of a sexual or threatening nature. But the trial judge excluded that. We were talking about maybe an hour's testimony at most from the three witnesses that she excluded. In the context of this case, with the particular facts of this case, I think it was an abuse of discretion to exclude those three witnesses. I want to move on lastly and urge the members of the court, if you have not already done so, to look at the video of TY. In all the years I've been trying cases, I did something in this trial that I've never done before. At the end of the defense, I played TY's interview with the detective. One, because of the fact that there were clear contradictions between what he said in the video and what he testified to, and to amplify those contradictions for the purposes of argument. But more importantly, to show that this kid, just on tape, on video, being interviewed by the detective, was inherently incredible. He joked. He yawned. He, at the end,
Mr. Seitz, Justice Nakayama has a question.
Mr. Seitz, are you asking us to judge the credibility of a witness?
No, I am.
You are asking us to do that, and you know that that's not appropriate.
No, I'm not asking you to judge. I'm telling you simply that if you look at the way in which this young man acted, you will have a better and a deeper understanding of what our defense consisted of. It wasn't simply that he was incredible. It was that this whole situation was staged at trial in a manner that produced a result that is in no way reliable, in no way fair, and extremely unjust. We had here a prosecutor who manipulated the situation in ways that I considered to have been very offensive and highly abusive. And we had a judge who was trying her last trial, and if you read the comments of the judge, she just simply did not assert control in a number of different situations in this case. Well, and the most
precise, didn't she sustain a number of objections that you raised on some on these issues?
She sustained many of my objections, but the prosecutor was allowed to come back and raise the same issues that had been sustained. And for example, as was just asked of the opposing counsel, with regard to the transcript of the testimony of the two other kids who testified. In the motion limine hearing, the judge flatly denied the request to call those witnesses to testify unless there was a hearsay exception that was laid out first and foremost. The language of the court at that point is very clear. I'm not going to allow it. And yet it came up and it was allowed eventually as well. There were many instances where the judge ruled and the prosecutor violated either the letter or the spirit of those rulings and was allowed to argue things to the jury that should have been precluded. And again,
with regard to the three questions, so the second objection was sustained. She asked the question again, but you didn't object at that time, nor did you ask for a mistrial.
We objected to the second question. We did not ask for a mistrial. You're correct. We did not ask for a mistrial. To be honest with you, I was stunned. Those witnesses were being handled by my young associate. I did not think it was necessary at that time to ask for a mistrial because, frankly, I thought that the conduct was so outrageous that it would have a detrimental effect on the jury. Obviously, I was wrong, but I don't think that constitutes a waiver with regard to the arguments we're making here today. This is an extremely serious case and a case in which I don't think that the evidence supports the outcome.
Judge Chang, you have a question.
Yes, Mr. Seitz, going back to the statement of T.Y.'s father about that ride out to the North Shore, when the defense did articulate its objection, did the defense request that the prior testimony of the witness be stricken?
No, because the prior testimony to that point in time was just simply that he called me and asked me to take a ride out to look at his roof, and so I went with him. And then the subsequent conversations, the subsequent testimony was, what were the conversations in the course of that ride? And then I began to object, and the objections are in the record.
Okay, thank you.
I have nothing further. I want to thank you for hearing us, and I also want to compliment the prosecutor. Her candor was very refreshing.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your arguments here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki'e hanohano o ka moko aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.